Okay, so it's my pleasure to bring up author Anaisha Rochowdhury. I hope I said that right. I got close. I didn't practice it enough. But I'm really excited that she's here, and she wrote this amazing book, which she's going to share with you. So here we go.
Hello. Oh, it's that spooky thing where I can barely see anyone. I want to thank Darius for inviting me to be here. I was telling him that I feel like a lot of the music that we're hearing tonight, it engages with questions that keep me up at night, and I'm sure they keep a lot of you up at night. You know, these questions of what does it mean to be an American, and what does America stand for? And it's obviously a pretty intense and brutal reckoning, but I feel like unless we do that, then we can't own those terms ourselves. And I think it's so important for us to find a way to define those terms ourselves, because if we don't, we know what happens, right? Other people do. And I also want to say, obviously, everyone here is going to vote. I know that tomorrow. But also just a reminder that what we're fighting for is bigger than tomorrow. The work we're doing is bigger than tomorrow. So no matter what happens tomorrow, there's so much more work that's happening and that needs to be done and will be done. And one of the most heartening things since this last presidential election is seeing how many people have become really profoundly engaged. And we're seeing unprecedented levels of people coming out and protesting and engaging in direct action. And when I say unprecedented, I mean both in terms of the number of actions that are happening and the numbers of people showing up at them. So there's this rekindled sense of civic engagement, which I think is just so heartening and is really the only thing that's going to create real change in this country. So I'm going to read a little bit from the introduction of my book, which I started writing immediately after this last presidential election. I have a background as both a journalist and a creative writer, and I covered the George W. Bush years for a while. So when the Trump election happened, I was starting to have some PTSD flashbacks and fears of things being worse. So I'll just jump right in. During a recent visit with my mother, I sat flipping through an old photo album I'd never seen before. Inside were images of our extended family on my mother's side, stretching back to the time I was about 4 years old. My mother sat close to me, leaning in to offer captions as I turned the pages. I was laughing at the way I could chart the march of adolescence by my increasingly less amused facial expressions. As my cheeks began to grow more slender, the open smile transformed, offering up a paltry, tight-lipped semblance instead. Toward the end of the album was an image that startled me. My mother and I sitting around a large table at a restaurant, most of her side of the family arranged in seats, beaming at the camera. My face, the only brown one at the table, stands out for another reason. I'm not even attempting a smile. In fact, I look furious. I noticed that my mother, who'd been eagerly narrating the who, what, and where of each image, had gone silent. When I turned to look at her, she said simply, "Oh, what?" I asked. My mother looked uncomfortable. "Well," she said, if you don't remember, maybe it's better that way." This, of course, only piqued my curiosity. "Tell me," I said. My mother sighed. The dinner was to celebrate her parents' wedding anniversary. My uncle had just finished going around the table with his video camera in hand, naming everyone at that table, except he had skipped over us. Here was a historical moment I had forgotten until it resurfaced. Uncle Bill didn't, quote, believe in mixed marriage. Growing up, if I ever found myself in the same room as him or around the same dinner table as him, I could rely on one thing. He would not acknowledge my existence. He did not look at me, and he did not speak to me. My general response was to simply ignore Bill the way he ignored me, though it would take me years before I could articulate how there was a power differential at play. He ignored me because my existence challenged his sensibilities. I ignored him because his sensibilities challenged my existence. In retrospect, I'm grateful for the experience of growing up around my Uncle Bill. Encountering racism and its tolerance in my own family gave me a model for what it means to grow up in America. Before I found my way to placing this experience in a broader framework of the institutional racism at the heart of this country's founding, it was a personal, even shameful story to hold. I didn't want to look at it any more closely because I feared that if I scratched the surface, what I would come away with were concrete reasons why I was less worthy of acknowledgement, of acceptance, even of existence in this country. These questions of who belongs and who doesn't, who is a person worth counting and who isn't, have always preoccupied us in America. In 2008, just days before the presidential election, Minnesota Republican Michelle Bachmann accused Barack Obama and other congressional Democrats of harboring anti-American views and suggested that the media investigate possible un-American activities. Vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin referred repeatedly to real America, which was apparently located only in small rural areas of the country. Shows like Saturday Night Live, The Colbert Report, and The Daily Show all parodied the rise of public figures like Palin and Bachmann. We laughed along with a fringe wig Tina Fey as she repeated lines from Palin's media appearances almost verbatim, raising the question of what purpose satire serves in our contemporary political era. What we understood was that when Tina Fey repeated what Palin said, Fey didn't mean what she was saying. This restored a sense of sanity to those of us who could not or did not want to believe that people like Palin and Bachmann could represent America. We laughed along knowingly, cynically, but above all, dismissively. These people were ridiculous. What was happening in the country was ridiculous. And we sought solace by feeling somehow separate from and unsullied by it all. Thankfully, we were granted a reprieve. This appeal to the narrative of division, separating the real from the fake, the American from the un-American, didn't take. Barack Obama won the election in a landslide victory, insisting on an America of inclusion. As cynical and detached as many of us had grown after 8 years of the Bush administration, Obama appealed to us on remarkably earnest grounds with rallying cries of "Yes, we can," and hope throughout his campaign. At his victory rally, facing a throng of hundreds of thousands of supporters at Grant Park in Chicago, Obama reiterated his message of inclusion, noting that his election was, quote, "the answer spoken by young and old, rich and poor, Democrat and Republican, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, Native American, gay, straight, disabled, and not disabled. Americans who sent a message to the world that we have never been just a collection of individuals or a collection of red states and blue states. We are and always will be the United States of America." What might have happened if McCain and Palin had won the election? It was a question I did not think about. Democracy had proven itself. America had proven itself. I suddenly proudly stood behind both of those tricky and malleable terms as though they had finally delivered on their promises. I, like the other 69.5 million Americans who had voted for Obama, the highest number of votes ever won by a president, 43% of which came from white voters, was in shock that the election had so swiftly been won, and by a black man, no less. After years of covering the George W. Bush administration as a journalist, I was exhausted. I had watched as White House spokespeople denied facts published on the front pages of every major paper. It felt like a clear refusal to acknowledge reality, a strategy I was deeply troubled to see confirmed when journalist Ron Suskin published a story citing what a Bush aide, later revealed to be Karl Rove, had told him in 2004. Quote, "When we act, we create our own reality, and while you're studying that reality, judicially as you will, we'll act again, creating other new realities, which you can study too, and that's how things will sort out. We're history's actors, and you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do." If those in power were banking on our complacency, if they were so cynically disdainful of reality itself, what hope was there for the rest of us? Obama's election, his earnest appeal to those values of equality, inclusivity, and his respect for facts and a shared reality, was the first time I had felt genuine hope in years. Like so many other Americans, I let Obama's election serve as a balm. Over the next 8 years, I became more complacent, more trusting of those in power. My guy had won, so I could sit and enjoy the victory, right? I could trust that those executive powers that had continued to expand in scope over the past 5 decades and gave the president unprecedented unchecked power were probably in trustworthy hands, right? But history cannot be severed from the present moment. Fast forward to 2016, When Donald Trump, who between the years of 2011 and 2014 repeatedly questioned whether Obama was born in the United States, was named the president-elect. Also, there's this. For 13 years, one of Trump's closest mentors was Roy Kahn, Senator Joseph McCarthy's lawyer during the communist witch hunt that was made manifest in the House Un-American Activities Committee. Which is to say, this narrative of the un-American has always been in the present, right alongside the narrative of America and democracy as shorthand for the promises of equality and inclusivity, right alongside those of us who would, with a countervailing cynicism, count ourselves apart, sitting at home, mainlining episodes of late-night comedy, laughing half-heartedly at a country and leadership we refuse to take responsibility for. A man who bragged about grabbing a woman by the pussy, accused a judge of having a conflict of interest because he had Mexican heritage, mocked a reporter's disability, was going to be sitting in the White House. It's not that I didn't believe it could happen. It's that I was terrified of what was to come. I was not wrong to be terrified. Within a few weeks of the election, there was a disturbing uptick in hate crimes across the country, even in New York City, at neighborhood playgrounds where newly spray-painted swastikas, Muslims punched on park benches in Queens, one of the most diverse regions on the planet. An Asian man on a train was beaten and told to go back to your country. It had begun. The emboldening of bigots and bigotry that trickled into every stratum of our social and political lives, revealing a frightening and uncertain atmosphere, one in which the terms of the debate and terms of reality, whether they be around dinner tables or in the halls of Congress, were up for grabs. The intensity of the fears I had during the Bush years flooded my system all over again. Where White House officials under Bush were cagey toward the press, Trump declared a wholesale war on journalists, tweeting that the press was the enemy of the people. Sexual assault became locker room talk. Racism became a bold refusal to cower to political correctness. Neo-Nazis became the alt-right. We were moving from the George W. era of truthiness to the Trump era of alternative facts. In other words, from some frayed cord still connected to the truth to an utter rending of that cord. I was also deeply afraid of a return to the disaffection and cynicism that had grown rampant during the two terms of George W. Bush's presidency. Not my president became a rallying cry after Trump's election, a sentiment that captured what many of us were feeling, but one that also raised the question of who did have power. Despite a growing shift to the left in Americans' beliefs on issues ranging from support of gay marriage to single-payer health insurance, the platforms of Democratic political leadership remain quite a few steps behind, while those of Republicans are just blatantly out of step. This dissonance is nothing new. In the late Reagan years, for instance, 70% of Americans thought there should be a constitutional guarantee of health care, even as Reagan railed against socialized medicine for every American. For decades, political scientists have pointed to the absence of a robust political party that represents the interests of everyday Americans as a primary reason so many choose to sit elections out. In particular, the absence of a thriving laborite or socialist party, the latter of which had historically represented the interests of a cross-section of the labor, peace, civil rights, and civil liberties movements. The decline in unions, which have historically advocated for workers' rights and often worked as a powerful organizing force for Democratic candidates, plays a part in this alienation too. While unions were key to the victories of Democratic presidents like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, both of those presidents failed to pass robust labor law reforms to strengthen unions. In the last 40 years, union membership has fallen from 26 to 10.7%. In the wake of the election, a story emerged. Headlines breathlessly lamented how polarized Americans had become. This narrative has been recycled over and over in op-eds and think pieces, reflected in new polls, numbers that try to quantify how much it is we cannot stand each other, have no common ground, live in different Americas. Yet the more closely I examine the dissonance between the turn our country seemed to take in this last presidential election, the clearer it became that we're lacking an instructive narrative that reflects the reality we're actually in. For at least the past 15 years, Americans have continued, again, to express increasingly liberal values and beliefs. Since 2011, there have been waves of social movements, many following on the heels of Occupy Wall Street, that have gained power and visibility, from racial justice movements like Black Lives Matter, to immigrants' rights movements like the Dreamers, to climate justice movements like the Climate Justice Alliance. That many of these movements have successfully collaborated and organized together counters another story we're often told. That protest is ineffectual, that the progressive movement is too fractured, too consumed with identity politics to be a broadly mobilizing force. The ranks of people concerned enough to take a stand have grown. In the days after the election, millions flooded the streets in the United States and around the world to let it be known that they stand against bigotry, misogyny, and exclusionary policies. What if, instead of viewing this as a country divided, we view it as a country in a political moment when we do not have the leadership the majority of us want and deserve? The narrative chasm is of a different sort, not between Americans themselves, but between Americans and the political leadership that no longer represents them, which is why this political moment and how we choose to respond is so important. If we buy into the cynicism that there is nothing to be done, we lose sight of the world we already live in. We let the Roves and Trumps of the world dictate reality. After decades of progressive momentum, we've reached an important juncture where we either surrender our narrative, our reality, to those in power, or hold fast and push forward. To choose now as the moment in which we give in to cynicism and say, what's the point, is to throw into the fire the history books of a future generation, the ones that might tell the story of how Americans seize democracy from the clutches of an elite handful of cynical, opportunistic, and aging extremists. The stakes have never been higher. Every day brings new initiatives aimed at turning back the clock, consolidating wealth in the hands of the 1%, slashing access to medical care and education, removing protections for the most marginalized among us. There are now countless opportunities for action, but that also means more opportunities to feel hopeless and disempowered. If we don't reframe our relationship to our own power and recognize the vital role we must play now, we sacrifice our current challenging reality to one that may become unsurvivable. Now is the time for us to set the terms of the conversation, to push back with the reality we insist on. To argue that we are powerless is to echo Rove's history's actors ideology perfectly. This is why the cynical narrative is so dangerous. It can be much easier to believe that there's nothing we can do. Hope and action are dangerous things. They speak of time, effort, investment, of giving a shit, of potential failure. For too long, hope has been associated with a kind of humorless, dewy-eyed naivete. But look back on the civil rights era. Who would argue that those fighting to end Jim Crow laws were naive? Hope is only naive when it's divorced from action and investment. With those forces in play, it becomes a revolutionary muscle. It is what sustains long-term vision, something many of us too easily relinquish in the face of opposition. As LGBTQ activist Ray Carey entreated in the wake of Trump's election, just take a few seconds and imagine a world where we are truly free, where you are truly free. What will that feel like? It was my Uncle Bill who I was thinking of when one day recently in Brooklyn, a man boarded my subway train and let loose an impassioned and bigoted tirade. My fellow New Yorkers did their job of ignoring him admirably, but he didn't keep up his end of the bargain, which was to move on after a few stops and pester the next car down. After 15 minutes straight of his proselytizing, some passengers told him to shut up. He wouldn't. Some tried reasoning with him. But here's the thing about narcissistic ideologues. They don't respond to logic or dissuasion in the name of facts or reason. We could fact check him all day and night, but he wasn't playing by the rules of the game. In that moment, I wrestled with a familiar feeling of resignation and powerlessness. I closed my eyes in the stuffy train and thought to myself, it'll be over soon. But I was tired of allowing the loudest and most bombastic among us to take control by default. I decided if the man would not shut up, the only way to improve the situation would be to make it so we no longer had to listen to him. I told him that if he wouldn't stop talking, I would start singing. He kept talking, so I sang. The first round of Row, Row, Row Your Boat was shaky and a little off-key. It was all I could muster. But a few people joined in the next round, and by the third, everyone on the train was singing robustly, including a couple kids in strollers who clapped their hands in glee. The proselytizer tried to get loud, but we got louder. Suddenly, we were no longer the audience for a hateful man. He got off at the next stop, yet we kept singing a few more rounds, smiling at each other and enjoying the simple joy of the reality and world that we'd reclaimed. I know that we cannot simply sing Trump off the train, But I wonder at the strategic uses of ignoring the loudest bigot on that train by turning our attention and intentions toward each other, that quieter majority. I wonder at the strategic uses of denial and disbelief, that privilege I've occasionally allowed myself in order to feel more free as a brown woman to say and think what I please, to not police myself with the expectations of bigots and buffoons. I think about the lunch counter sit-ins during the civil rights era, how at the heart of the strategy was a refusal to accept unjust laws and policies, to strategically ignore the rules and insist on a different world, one in which black men and women could sit and eat at the same counter as any other human being. I want to take this principle and apply it more broadly. How can we actively, strategically ignore Donald Trump? A part of that answer lies in recognizing the power we already have and counting ourselves in rather than sitting on the sidelines. History is happening now, and we are history's actors. There are millions of us who are fighting for the same things, and millions more who want the same things but call them by a different name. Yet we still seem to struggle to understand ourselves as a movement. We struggle to recognize and take responsibility for how powerful we are. The shape of our potential remains a dotted line describing the parameters of something we're hesitant to inhabit and lay claim to. Part of this is about the anemic narratives on offer, about the marginalized, the ineffectual, and disorganized left. For too long, we've accepted stories that disenfranchise us, even when they fly in the face of facts, logic, and our shared reality. We have all come of age in a society that privileges white Americans, particularly straight white cisgender men. But this has become an increasingly odd dissonance with the reality of our population. Only 31% of Americans today are white men. The marginalized are now the majority, but our narratives around power haven't kept up. The movements we've seen coming together in the Women's March and in the protests that are occurring every day around the country, the roughly 6,000 chapters of local activist groups that have blossomed under the Indivisible umbrella, are not only a response to the demands of the moment. They are making their own demands that we renew our responsibility and relationship to the country that must be. They are the beginning of a new kind of politics that centralizes the role of the marginalized majority. We will need to keep at it long after Trump is deposed and reduced to a troubling chapter in our history books. The work now is writing the chapters that come next, built on our visions founded on a fierce hope, an aggressive we that demands of leaders current and future that they heed those in power, us. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We're going to take a short intermission here. Naisha's book is for sale, and also Shelley has some things for sale out there. Talk amongst one another, and we'll be right back. Thank you.